When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
This is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, and I welcome Adrian Wooldridge of The Economist magazine. He is Badgett. At the same time, he is Adrian Wooldridge, author of a new book, The Aristocracy of Talent, How Meritocracy Made the Modern World. Good heavens, this sweeps over an enormous period of history, from kingships reaching back all the way to Plato and then right up till now. Meritocrats is the word. It was invented in the 20th century. But we begin with what Adrian introduces as a ditty from the 19th century to describe the contest for finding why people are elevated and why people are not elevated in human history. It goes like this. God bless the squire and his relations and keep us in our proper stations. Adrian, good evening, and thank you, and congratulations. That ditty for me is your book, because the contest against that presumption that there is such a thing as proper stations has informed arguments for, well, at least 2,500 years. Let's begin with where you identify the hierarchical presumption of mankind. How did it work, and what was its genesis? What drove it, Adrian? Good evening to you.
John, thank you so much for inviting me, and thank you for starting off with such a profound question, because I think it's important to recognize that for most of human history, the assumptions that we now have about individualism, effort, merit, and reward have not been the assumptions that most people have had. Most people throughout most of history have believed that society is a hierarchy, that people should be born into their proper places, that family connections are more important than individual abilities, and that dynasty rather than individual achievement is the organizing principle of society. And you quoted that wonderful Victorian ditty. You could quote lots of ditties from the 18th century, the 16th century, or before that. And essentially the notion was people inherited their position in the world, that the king was the kingpin of society, that everybody drew their position from their relationship to the king. And that's how things should be. And any deviation from that was regarded as a terrible mistake. Social mobility was something to be feared, avoided, and crushed if it happened.
Walter Raleigh, you quote from the early 17th century, making the case that as nature blesses certain items, such as gems, hath also ordained king. So he was not bothered by what we would consider to be a false comparison. They went searching it with their poetic language for justification. Is that because there was a challenge right away? Why did Raleigh feel compelled to make that remark, given his fate, of course?
Well, I think that he was reflecting the notion of the great chain of being. And that is the notion that everybody and everything in the universe has its proper place ordained by God. So the king is on the throne, the earthworm is burrowing in the ground, and they're all predestined to be doing what they're doing. And you get these marvelous statements by Shakespeare saying that if you fiddle with that order, if you untune that string, as he says in Ulysses, then discord follows. And Walter Raleigh is saying exactly the same thing. He's saying that if you interfere both with the human order and the natural order, which are in many ways manifestations of the same thing, you will cause chaos. And this will be a chaos which is in the natural world as well as in the human world. So you will have thunderstorms, you will have the hurricanes, you'll have massive natural disasters. And of course, his fate is to be executed. And he was, executed for subversion. So he was preaching, you know, the divine order of things, but he was to fall foul of the king and was to be executed.
You mentioned Shakespeare. Is it fair, Adrian, to assume that the mad scene with the storms in Lear is what the 17th and 18th century believed would happen if the king was not obeyed? Is that their vision?
Absolutely. You see this over and over and over again in Shakespeare, that when you have the social hierarchy being threatened and subverted, then you have the natural hierarchy threatened and subverted. So you have storms, you have mental unbalance, you have social unbalance. You see it in Julius Caesar, you see it in Othello, you see it over and over again, that there is a natural order of things ordained by God, and anything that untunes it, as Shakespeare, but anything that disturbs it will be manifested in natural disorder as well as human disorder. And this was an incredibly widely held set of beliefs. And it's a set of beliefs that lasted until relatively recently.
Yes, very recently. We're mentioning dynasty, or dynasty, as we in America use that word. And I'm struck by how there was always wise thinkers observing that kingship was fragile now and again. And you say that diplomacy was mostly dynasty building. They knew that depending upon a family required a lot of hard work. They knew this, Adrian, and it threatened them all the time. Is that correct? They worried about it.
Absolutely. Up until probably the middle of the 19th century, at least, the main institution in most societies in the world is the royal or the imperial dynasty. That's what keeps social order. That's the thing about which society revolves. And this, of course, puts a biological entity at the center of society, that biological entity being a king or a queen or an emperor. And those people are naturally subject to all the sins and the frailties and the problems of humanity. So if you might inherit a throne at the age of 2 years old, as James the Sixth of Scotland did, you might continue to live into your dotage whilst you're still the king or the queen, and you know, continue to have to make decisions when you're long past retirement age. You might go mad. You might be pretty dumb. You might be suffer from temporary madness, like George III, who was lucid some of the time and very far from lucid the rest of the time. So all of the frailties that human flesh is subject to is put on the throne. And there's also a second complication, which was with women. Women were conceived in these societies as being inferior, and yet if the daughter is the person who inherits the throne, suddenly you have a woman making all the decisions, like Elizabeth I on the throne. And then she goes from being an inferior person who is meant to bow down to her husband to being essentially the top person in the country and a revered person in the country to whom all men have to bow down. That is an enormous sort of psychological trauma. And, of course, dynasties have to reproduce themselves in order to survive. And that reproduction before modern medicine is an extremely difficult thing. It's very dangerous. Women can die in childbirth. You can have infertility, which means that the dynasty dies out, and then you get civil war between various competing dynasties. And so the urge to create a healthy male son is incredibly powerful. So Henry VIII is, you know, driven to madness, distraction, to murder. in order to get a healthy male son, which he never does.
I want to make note here because we're going to move beyond nepotism into the absolutist state. I want to make note how I smiled when you quoted Walter Badgett's opinion of every royal house in Europe in 1802 as madness. That's wonderful. Did he get in trouble for saying that?
Well, the extraordinary thing about Walter Badgett, in whose name I write in The Economist, is that he is a conservative who believes that the queen or the king should be on the throne and that they're owed due deference. But he's incredibly contemptuous of these people. He says basically that they're idiots. He says that they should be idiots because nobody with any intelligence could do such a job. And he says that they're essentially decorations who distract the masses from the real rulers of the country, who are the members of cabinet. So he is simultaneously revered by the royal family. I mean, the Queen Elizabeth, our current queen, was brought up reading Badgett. But Badgett is saying, look, you're just the equivalent of a spaniel who everybody can look at. And don't get too clever because you're not meant to be clever. You're just meant to be a fool. So we can all live under the illusion that you make a difference. Well, real clever people like us can make all the decisions.
The book is The Aristocracy of Talent, How Meritocracy Made the Modern World. Adrian Wooldridge is the author. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.